Hello, this is Chris Wilhelm, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, October 3rd issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our headline today, Trump determined the U.S. is now in a war with drug cartels, Congress is told. A notice calls the people the U.S. military recently killed on suspicion of drug smuggling in the Caribbean Sea unlawful combatants. By Charlie Savage and Eric Schmidt. President Trump has decided that the United States is engaged in a formal armed conflict with drug cartels his team has labeled terrorist organizations, and that suspected smugglers for such groups are unlawful combatants, the administration said in a confidential notice to Congress this week. The notice was sent to several congressional committees and obtained by the New York Times. It adds new detail to the administration's thinly articulated legal rationale for why three U.S. military strikes the president ordered on boats in the Caribbean Sea last month, killing all 17 people aboard them, should be seen as lawful rather than murder. Mr. Trump's move to formally deem his campaign against drug cartels as an active armed conflict means he is cementing his claim to extraordinary wartime powers, legal specialists said. In an armed conflict, as defined by international law, a country can lawfully kill enemy fighters even when they pose no threat, detain them indefinitely without trials, and prosecute them in military courts. Jeffrey S. Korn, a retired judge advocate general lawyer who was formerly the Army's senior advisor for law of war issues, said drug cartels were not engaged in hostilities, the standard for when there is an armed conflict for legal purposes, against the United States because selling a dangerous product is different from an armed attack. Noting that it is illegal for the military to deliberately target civilians who are not directly participating in hostilities, even suspected criminals, Mr. Korn called the president's move an abuse that crossed a major legal line. This is not stretching the envelope, he said. This is shredding it. This is tearing it apart. Anna Kelly, a White House spokeswoman, said in an email that the president acted in line with the law of armed conflict to protect our country from those trying to bring deadly poison to our shores, and he is delivering on his promise to take on the cartels and eliminate these national security threats from murdering more Americans. The Trump administration has called the strikes self-defense and asserted that the laws of war permitted it to kill rather than arrest the people on the boats because it said the targets were smuggling drugs for cartels it has designated as terrorists. The administration has also stressed that tens of thousands of Americans die annually from overdoses. However, the focus of the administration attacks has been boats from Venezuela. The surge of overdose deaths in recent years has been driven by fentanyl, which drug trafficking experts say comes from Mexico, not South America. Beyond factual issues, the bare-bones argument has been broadly criticized on legal grounds by specialists in armed conflict law. The notice to Congress, which was deemed controlled but unclassified, cites a statute requiring reports to lawmakers about hostilities involving U.S. armed forces. It repeats the administration's earlier arguments, but also goes further with new claims, including portraying U.S. military's attacks on boats to be part of a sustained, active conflict rather than isolated acts of claimed self-defense. Specifically, it says that Mr. Trump has determined that cartels engaged in smuggling drugs are non-state armed groups whose actions constitute an armed attack against the United States, and it cites a term for international law, a non-international armed conflict, that refers to a war with a non-state actor. Based upon the cumulative effects of these hostile acts against citizens and interests of the United States and friendly foreign nations, the president determined that the United States is in a non-international armed conflict with these designated terrorist organizations, the notice said. There are different kinds of wars, and the concept of a non-international armed conflict developed in 20th century law to mean a civil war in one country as opposed to a war between two or more nation states. After the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, when the United States went to war against Al-Qaeda, a non-state actor operating across multiple countries, some legal scholars objected that the Bush administration was stretching the rules to justify using wartime powers against a group they likened more to a criminal band of pirates. But the Supreme Court found that the conflict with Al-Qaeda was a real war. It blessed as lawful the Bush administration's use of wartime power to hold captured Al-Qaeda members in indefinite detention without trial, while also saying the government was bound by the Geneva Conventions to treat such prisoners humanely and not torture them. The court's reasoning, however, turned on the fact that Al-Qaeda had attacked the United States, using hijacked airplanes as weapons to intentionally kill people, and that Congress had authorized the use of armed force against it. Indeed, in a 2006 ruling, the court also rejected the Bush administration's first attempt to use military commissions, saying that lawmakers needed to explicitly authorize them. In this case, the Trump administration is conflating the trafficking of an illicit consumer product and associated crime with an armed attack, asserting that the notice that cartels illegally and directly cause the deaths of tens of thousands of American citizens each year. But it has not explained how selling a dangerous substance constitutes a use of force, and Congress has not authorized the use of any type of military force against cartels. The U.S. government has routinely said it is engaged in a metaphorical war on drugs, meaning aggressive law enforcement. Mr. Trump's claim that he can and has put the country into a literal state of war against drug cartels is important for legal reasons. Police arrest suspected drug dealers. It would be a crime to instead summarily gun them down. But in an armed conflict, it is lawful to kill combatants for the opposing force on site. The notice to Congress also justified the most recent publicly disclosed attack on a boat, in which U.S. Special Operations Forces killed all three people aboard the vessel on September 15th by calling the crew unlawful combatants as if they were soldiers on a battlefield. The vessel was assessed by the U.S. intelligence community to be affiliated with a designated terrorist organization, and at the time, engaged in trafficking illicit drugs, which could ultimately be used to kill Americans, the notice said. This strike resulted in the destruction of the vessel, the illicit narcotics, and the death of approximately three unlawful combatants. The notice to Congress did not specifically name any of the drug cartels with which Mr. Trump claims the United States is engaged in an armed conflict. It also did not specify any standards the administration is using to determine whether particular suspects have sufficient links to such groups for the military to kill them. Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, the top Democrat on the Armed Services Committee, accused Mr. Trump of deciding that he could wage secret wars against anyone he calls an enemy. The president offered no credible legal justification, evidence, or intelligence for the strikes, Mr. Reed said. Drug cartels are despicable and must be dealt with by law enforcement, he said. But now, by the president's own words, the U.S. military is engaged in armed conflict with undefined enemies. He has unilaterally labeled unlawful combatants, and he has deployed thousands of troops, ships, and aircraft against them. Yet he has refused to inform Congress or the public. But Sean Parnell, the chief Pentagon spokesman, said the Defense Department was successfully prosecuting this critical mission in compliance with both domestic and international law, and in accordance with the law of armed conflict. The department has provided the required notifications to Congress. Still, Brian Finucane, a former State Department lawyer who is a specialist in the laws of armed conflict and has criticized the boat attacks, expressed skepticism. Among other things, under international law, for a non-state entity to be part of an armed conflict, it must meet the standard of being an organized armed group, he noted. Not surprised that the administration may have settled on such a theory to legally backfill their operations, he said. I had speculated they might do so. One major problem, however, is that it is far from clear that whoever they are targeting is an organized armed group, such that the U.S. could be in a NIAC with it, he said, referring to a non-international armed conflict. Mr. Finucane questioned whether the gang the Trump administration has most talked about targeting, Tren El Aragua, is coherent enough to meet that threshold. An intelligence assessment in April, which was declassified and made public the following month, said the Venezuelan group consisted of loosely organized cells of localized individual criminal networks and was so decentralized that it would be difficult for it to coordinate actions. Most voters think Americans' divisions cannot be overcome, poll says. A new Times Siena survey shows a significant shift among voters as their concerns about the health of the political system overtake other issues. By Jeremy W. Peters and Ruth Agilnik. Americans have markedly less faith in the ability of the country's political system to solve problems than they had 5 years ago, with a large majority now believing that the country is incapable of overcoming its deep divisions, according to a poll by the New York Times and Siena University. Even in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, when the country was fighting over mask mandates and forced to reckon with questions about racial inequality, a majority of voters still agreed that the country was capable of solving its political problems. Today, just 33% of voters feel the same. The steep rise in pessimism reflects a striking shift in the public's perceptions about what ails the country. After the economy, the polls found that Americans were most likely to point to problems in the political culture as the most urgent. They named polarization and the state of democracy more often than immigration, inflation, or crime. The Times-Siena poll of 1,313 registered voters taken between September 22nd and 27th was conducted at an especially fraught moment, roughly 2 weeks after the assassination of the right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. And it was taken before the government shutdown that began at midnight Wednesday, a development likely to reinforce the negative feelings that American voters have about the division and dysfunction in politics. "It is impossible now to have a policy discussion," said Amber Yang, 37, of Boston, who works in finance and identifies as a Democrat. She said the polarization has seeped into most aspects of life, complicating running a business and even raising a family. "There's no consensus on the facts," she added. "And when you can't have a conversation, how do you even move forward?" Even though the national mood is bleak, Americans still possess some sense of hope and goodwill toward the other side, the poll found. Only a small fraction of voters, for instance, seem comfortable demonizing opponents. When Democrats were asked whether they think of Republicans as the enemy or as fellow Americans, whom they disagree with politically, only 10% chose the harsher description, a modest decline from last year. And 14% of Republicans said they think of Democrats as the enemy, a slight increase. When it comes to free speech, 60% said that they felt comfortable expressing their views, though vastly more Republicans felt freer than Democrats. There was widespread agreement on another freedom of speech issue. Nearly all Democrats and independents, and 57% of Republicans, said they opposed revoking the licenses of television stations that air programs that criticize President Trump. Overall, however, the poll captured an electorate at a moment when it was struggling with deep doubts about the vitality of American democracy. A majority of Americans, 55%, said they would describe the United States as a democratic country, but a sizable portion, 41%, disagreed, including 52% of Democrats and 40% of independents. The poll also revealed how deeply entrenched partisanship has become. Half of the voters say Mr. Trump is a unique threat to the American system of government. The other half thinks Mr. Trump is presiding over an improved or stable economy and has done an excellent job of keeping his campaign promises. "Unfortunately, it feels like you have to pick a side," said Al Heyman, 49, of Jefferson Parish, Louisiana, who supports Mr. Trump. He acknowledged that the president was reckless with his words, often with inflammatory results. But Mr. Heyman was quick to add that Democrats and some in the news media share blame for the polarization, as they seem to blame Mr. Trump anytime something goes wrong. "Stuff has gotten out of hand," he added. "It's just pulling sides apart when we really need to come together to make things happen, but neither side wants to do that." Before the 2024 election, polls showed that people were more likely to identify issues such as inflation, abortion, and immigration as most important to their vote. polarization barely registered. Today, spasms of political violence have erupted across the country with alarming frequency, including the killings of Mr. Kirk and of Minnesota State Senator and her husband in June. Asked who is to blame for the discord, respondents agreed, the other side. Asked to name the biggest problems, Democrats said Mr. Trump and the Republican Party first, ahead of the economy. I feel like I'm living in an episode of The Twilight Zone, said Leah Smith, a 50-year-old Democrat living in New York who believes the Trump administration's policies have been unfair to women, black people, and LGBTQ community members. When Republicans were asked to identify the biggest problem, the economy was first, followed by Democrats. The government shutdown could offer a point of agreement. Asked which party should be blamed for the shutdown, 19% said Democrats in Congress, 26% said Mr. Trump and the Republicans in Congress. One-third of voters, however, said they would blame both parties equally. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump calls shutdown an unprecedented opportunity and eyes deep cuts. The president plans to meet with the White House budget chief to slash what he described as Democrat agencies, by Tony Rahm. President Trump said on Thursday that he would meet with his budget chief to determine which Democrat agencies he could try to cut, relishing the government shutdown as an unprecedented opportunity to achieve his agenda and dismantle federal programs. Mr. Trump did not specify in a post on social media whether he sought to slash spending or lay off federal workers, both of which he has threatened since federal funding lapsed. Rather, the president said his discussion with Russell T. Vogt, the White House budget director, would touch on whether or not those cuts will be temporary or permanent. Shortly after, Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, signaled anew that Mr. Trump is eyeing another round of mass federal layoffs. She told reporters that it was likely the government could shed workers by the thousands if the shutdown continues, adding that the president would further refine the plan Thursday. The comments from Mr. Trump and his top aides underscored their desire to take advantage of the government-wide closure, which began at midnight on Wednesday. Rather than try to broker a resolution, the president has focused on leveraging the standoff, aiming to carry out his long-sought reconfiguration of Washington while inflicting pain on his political adversaries. I don't think it's unreasonable for the president to use all the levers, said Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, during an appearance on CNBC on Thursday. He declined to offer specifics about the layoffs or cuts the president was considering, but Mr. Bessent, nonetheless, acknowledged that a shutdown could hurt the U.S. economy. On Capitol Hill, senior Democratic lawmakers responded to Mr. Trump's ultimatums with outrage. Senator Patty Murray of Washington, the top Democrat on the chamber's appropriations panel, faulted the White House for using federal workers as bargaining chips and questioned the legality of any firings conducted while the government remains closed. It is unprecedented and irresponsible for the President of the United States to threaten innocent people rather than coming to work with us to negotiate an agreement to get government open, Ms. Murray said. On the first day of the shutdown, Mr. Trump and his top aides halted about $26 billion in previously approved funding for infrastructure and green energy projects, primarily in Democratic-run states. The administration appeared to single out New York, a state whose delegation includes Representative Hakeem Jeffries and Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democrats' leaders in the House and Senate. Mr. Vogt also told Republican lawmakers on a call Wednesday that mass layoffs targeting federal workers were imminent, suggesting that the administration could focus on employees who serve in roles that do not comport with the president's political agenda. Many federal workers are already furloughed, and others are forced to work during the shutdown without pay, prompting unions to sue to block the firings. The White House declined to comment on the meeting. For the president and Mr. Vogt, their tactics marked an escalation in a cost-cutting campaign that began at the start of Mr. Trump's second term and the early work of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Through more than 8 months, they have dismissed droves of civil servants, closed agencies, and canceled billions of dollars in spending. sometimes in ways that have tested the law and defied Congress. By December, the federal government is expected to employ 300,000 fewer workers than it did in January, a reflection of the administration's massed firings and induced resignations. And Mr. Trump and Mr. Vote have pursued a dramatic retrenchment in government spending, proposing a budget that would slash about $163 billion in the 2026 fiscal year, largely eliminating a vast set of climate, education, health, and housing programs, including some that benefit the poor. In his social media post, Mr. Trump on Thursday referenced Mr. Vote's work on Project 2025, the right-wing blueprint that similarly called for an overhaul of the federal government. In that document, Mr. Vote opined on the existential need for aggressive use of the vast powers of the executive branch. Mr. Trump's renewed attacks on Democrats appeared to undercut his own deputies, including Vice President J.D. Vance, who just a day earlier insisted that the president was not seeking to politicize the shutdown. "We are not targeting federal agencies based on politics," he told reporters at a briefing on Wednesday. Mr. Vance instead maintained that layoffs, in particular, would help the government preserve essential services, even though agencies have not had to dismiss workers in previous government shutdowns. Energy Department cancels $7.5 billion for hundreds of projects, mostly in blue states. The cuts largely affect Democratic-led states as the two parties fight over the shutdown of the federal government. By Brad Plummer and Maxine Giosolo. The Energy Department said on Wednesday night that it would cancel more than $7.5 billion in Biden-era awards for hundreds of energy projects, with the vast majority located in states led by Democrats. The move underscored how the Trump administration appeared to be using the government shutdown as a pretext to punish its political opponents. President Trump said this week that if Democrats in Congress did not vote for a funding bill to keep the government open, he would do things during the shutdown that are irreversible, that are bad for them. In its Wednesday announcement, the Energy Department did not specify which projects would see their funding terminated, but according to an agency document reviewed by the New York Times, the list of affected projects include major upgrades to electrical grids in California, Minnesota, and Oregon, efforts to reduce methane leaks from oil and gas operations in Colorado, and large hubs to produce clean-burning hydrogen fuels in California and the Pacific Northwest. The vast majority of the 321 canceled awards would have gone toward projects in those states, as well as Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, New Mexico, New York, and Washington, the document showed. Those states all have Democratic governors and senators. In a news release, the Energy Department said it had determined that the projects did not adequately advance the nation's energy needs, were not economically viable, and would not provide a positive return on investment of taxpayer dollars. The agency said that recipients would have 30 days to appeal any terminations. If those appeals are unsuccessful, the recipients could potentially sue the Energy Department, much as award cancellations by the Environmental Protection Agency have faced legal challenges. There is no law that allows a federal agency to cancel previously awarded grants during a government shutdown. Companies or universities that receive federal funding typically sign a legally binding agreement and then spend their own money on the expectation that they will be reimbursed later. The cancellations appear to have been months in the making. Political appointees at the Energy Department have been reviewing billions of dollars worth of climate and infrastructure spending that was awarded by the Biden administration, claiming that the money was rushed out the door by providing few details about specific problems. The agency's announcement met swift condemnation from Governor Gavin Newsom of California, where one of the projects facing cuts was projected to create more than 220,000 jobs. In Trump's America, energy policy is set by the highest bidder. Economics and common sense be damned, Mr. Newsom said in a statement. We'll continue to pursue an all-of-the-above clean energy strategy that powers our future and cleans the air, no matter what D.C. tries to dictate. Before the Energy Department announced the cancellations, Russell T. Vogt, the White House budget director, said in social media posts that they were imminent. nearly $8 billion in Green New Scam funding to fuel the left's climate agenda is being canceled, he wrote on X. Mr. Vogt did not provide details, and the Energy Department did not issue the news release until several hours later. In the meantime, many state officials, members of Congress, and energy executives were scrambling on Wednesday to figure out which projects would be affected. Two of the largest canceled awards would have provided $1.2 billion to projects in California and $1 billion to projects in the Pacific Northwest focused on the production, transportation, and storage of clean hydrogen. Hydrogen fuels have the potential to produce steel and fertilizer, or to power trucks without producing planet-warming greenhouse gas emissions. Congress has authorized roughly $8 billion for so-called hydrogen hubs as part of the bipartisan infrastructure law of 2021. The Biden administration awarded that money to 7 hubs across 16 states, although most of the funds had not been spent yet. None of the hubs in Republican-controlled states, such as West Virginia, Texas, and Louisiana, were affected by the latest round of cancellations. Greg Keolian, a professor at the University of Michigan whose research focuses on hydrogen, said the canceled funds would have helped the United States compete with China and Europe, which have more mature hydrogen industries. "We need to be investing in clean energy technologies like hydrogen for global competitiveness," Dr. Keolian said. Chris Green, the president of the Pacific Northwest Hydrogen Hub, said that while we are disappointed in the decision, our commitment to advancing hydrogen in the Pacific Northwest is unwavering. Republican-held states and districts were not entirely spared. The Pacific Northwest Hydrogen Hub was expected to create jobs in Montana, for instance. Some of the cuts would affect projects in states like Florida, South Carolina, and Texas, where a battery factory was being built with help from a $20 million federal grant that is now being canceled. Financial awards for 24 projects to upgrade the nation's electrical grids were also targeted for termination. According to the agency list, that includes $630 million to help upgrade 100 miles of transmission lines in California with advanced conductors that can carry more electrical current, as well as a $250 million grant to strengthen power lines on the Warm Springs Reservation in Central Oregon. Also targeted for cancellation was a $464 million grant awarded to Minnesota to help improve the connections between two large regional electrical grids in the Midwest and Great Plains. That project was aimed at making it easier to add more renewable energy to the grid and reducing the risk of blackouts. Proponents said it would have helped reduce electricity costs across a wide region, including in Republican-led states. The list of canceled funding also includes $326 million that had been awarded to Colorado State University to reduce leaks of methane, a potent planet-warming gas, from oil and gas wells. The cancellations would also affect more than $350 million in awards to the Gas Technology Institute of Illinois, which works on reducing emissions from methane, hydrogen, and other technologies. The Energy Department also canceled funding for projects to reduce emissions from cement production and to develop technology that traps and buries carbon dioxide from industrial smokestacks before the gas escapes into the atmosphere and heats the planet. Some of those terminations appear to have been previously announced in May. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Deadly attack outside UK synagogue on Yom Kippur is declared terrorism. The police identified the attacker as Jihad al-Shami, 35, a British citizen of Syrian descent. He was shot dead, the police said, after killing 2 people in Manchester, England. By Michael D. Shear, Lizzie Dearden, Stephen Castle, Emma Bubala, and Thomas Fuller. An attacker rammed a car into people outside a synagogue in Manchester, England, and then went on a stabbing spree on Thursday, killing 2 people in what the police called an act of terrorism on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar. The police said officers responded within minutes and shot and killed the attacker, whom they identified as Jihad al-Shami, 35, a British citizen of Syrian descent. Though the police described the assault as a terrorist attack, they said that counterterrorism investigators were still working to understand the motivation. Three other people were arrested, the police said, on suspicion of commission, preparation, and instigation of terrorism in connection with the assault outside the synagogue, the Heaton Park Hebrew congregation. The police did not name those arrested in accordance with privacy rules, but said they were two men in their 30s and a woman in her 60s. British officials said late Thursday that Mr. Al-Shami had entered the United Kingdom as a very young child and was granted British citizenship in 2006. Stephen Watson, the chief constable of the Greater Manchester Police, said the attacker, who seriously wounded three other people, was wearing a vest the constable described as having the appearance of an explosive device. Investigators later determined it was not capable of causing an explosion. The violence in Manchester comes amid heightened fears across Europe and the United States for the safety of Jews amid a rise in anti-Semitism related to the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. Prime Minister Keir Starmer of Britain called the attack absolutely shocking and described the assailant as a vile individual who wanted to attack Jews because they are Jews. He cut short a trip to Copenhagen, where he had been attending a conference of European leaders to lead a meeting of a government committee that handles national emergencies. Mr. Starmer said Britain had been hit by a hatred that is rising once again. The attack alarmed the Jewish community in Manchester, a multicultural city with large Jewish and Muslim populations, and prompted a surge in police protection at Jewish cultural and religious sites across the country. With no access to their phones during the holiday, some members of the Jewish community in the immediate areas of the synagogue did not know what happened until hours after the attack. "It's this new feeling among the community that this place is no longer safe," said Chen Bass, 27, a mother of two who lives in the area. "We think we will see more and more of this." The mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, told the BBC that the Jewish community had seen rising incidents of anti-Semitism over recent times, and that it had been living with a higher state of anxiety because of the times that we are living in. In a statement, the police said that records did not show that Mr. Al-Shami had been flagged to Britain's official counterterrorism operation as a potential threat. The authorities were conducting searches at two homes linked to the attacker and people arrested. One location was in Crumpsall, England, a short distance from the synagogue. The other was in the town of Prestwich, about 2 miles from the scene. Manchester, one of England's biggest metropolitan areas, is home to the largest Jewish community in the country outside London, about 30,000 people. The area's multiculturalism is the result of immigration from around the world. Since the start of 2017, 19 other violent attacks in Britain have been declared terrorism by the police or judges. Of those, 11 were classified as having an Islamist motive, 5 as right-wing and 1 as left-wing. In 2 of the attacks, the motive was unclear. None of those attacks took place at synagogues, but over the past decade, Jewish people and places of worship in Britain have featured in several terrorist plots thwarted by security services. Some were planned by neo-Nazis, and others by supporters of the Islamic State terrorist group, officials said. The Community Security Trust, a British charity that tracks anti-Semitism, said that all categories of attacks had increased since the start of the Israel-Hamas war in October 2023. It recorded 1,521 anti-Jewish hate episodes in the first 6 months of this year, including 73 assaults and 84 cases of damage and desecration to Jewish property, several of which took place at synagogues. In May 2017, Manchester was the site of one of Britain's deadliest terrorist attacks when a supporter of the Islamic State detonated a powerful bomb among Ariana Grande fans while they were leaving a concert at Manchester Arena. 22 people were killed and hundreds of others were injured. The suicide bomber, Salman Abedi, 22, had planned the attack with his younger brother, Hashem Abedi, who is serving a life sentence. Images of the assault on Thursday quickly spread across social media, including the moment officers shot and killed the attacker. Martin Hamer, a resident of Manchester who was driving through the neighborhood, initially thought there had been a traffic accident outside the synagogue. Then, he said, he saw the attacker trying to break into the synagogue through a window. Officials said the episode could have been far deadlier if not for what Chief Constable Watson described as the immediate bravery of security staff who prevented the attacker from getting into the synagogue. Osher Lufttag, 18, who lives in the area, said the father of a friend had braced the doors of the synagogue from inside to prevent the attacker from entering. Morning prayers had begun at 9, according to the synagogue's website, and scores of people were inside. Yom Kippur, a solemn day focused on repentance and becoming closer to God, requires congregants to spend 25 hours fasting and praying. As we got nearer, Mr. Hamer said in an interview, we realized there was a guy dead on the floor, and there was another guy fighting for his life in front of the car. He captured the scene with his phone in a video that his daughter posted on Facebook. The images show two armed police officers with their rifles aimed at the attacker on the ground outside the synagogue as a severely injured victim lay nearby. One of the officers yelled to people at the synagogue gates to move back, shouting, "He has a bomb! Go away!" Moments later, the attacker appeared to be trying to get up, and the police fired at least one shot. The man fell back to the ground. Condemnations of the day's violence came from across the political spectrum in Britain and around the world. Kemi Badenoch, leader of Britain's opposition Conservative Party, wrote on social media that people were murdered simply for being Jews. Ms. Badenoch noted that the attack came on a day when Jews ask themselves where we have gone wrong in the past and what we need to do to be better in the future. Ephraim Mirvis, chief rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregations of the Commonwealth, said in a social media post, British Jews are now grasping the full extent of today's terror attack at the Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester. This is the day we hoped we would never see, but which deep down we knew would come. He added, this is not only an assault on the Jewish community, but an attack on the very foundations of humanity. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel called the attack barbaric and said his nation grieves with the Jewish community in the UK. The U.S. Ambassador to Britain, Warren Stevens, said that what happened was sickening and that it served as a stark reminder of the rise of anti-Semitism and religious intolerance in our societies. Mr. Starmer, speaking from Downing Street, said, to every Jewish person in this country, I want to say this. I know how much fear you will be holding inside of you. He added, Britain will come together to wrap our arms around your community and show you that Britain is a place where you and your family are safe, secure, and belong. Many children missing, but no more signs of life in Indonesia's school collapse. Rescuers saved 5 more students from under the building on Thursday, but said they would end the search 3 days after the deadly accident. By Hasya Nindita. Rescuers in Indonesia who spent days frantically trying to save students trapped under a collapsed school said Thursday morning that they detected no more signs of life from under the rubble and would now focus on recovering bodies. 5 more students were pulled out alive from the Al-Khosni school in Sidoarjo, East Java province, on Thursday morning, bringing the number of rescued people to 14. 2 others were found dead, bringing the total death toll to 5. The National Disaster Management Agency estimated that 59 students were still trapped and presumed dead under the Islamic boarding school, which collapsed during a prayer service on Monday afternoon. It was unclear how many students were in the building when it fell. Indonesia has more than 30,000 Islamic boarding schools, or pesantren, which often draw children from rural areas, according to the Ministry of Religious Affairs. Al-Khosni, a secondary school built in 1964, has about 1,300 students from across the country. The decision to end the search was made after assessments by the National Search and Rescue Agency over the past 24 hours using sound equipment, thermal drones, and a wall scan to detect any motion from survivors. We did not detect any signs of life, so the joint team finally decided to enter the next stage, the search and evacuation stage, using heavy equipment, Surayanto, the head of the National Disaster Management Agency, said at a news conference. Officials said they did not use the machines earlier out of concern that they could cause the structure to collapse further and endanger those still alive. Rescuers asked grieving family members for consent before utilizing the heavy equipment on Thursday afternoon. They also took DNA samples from the victims' families to track who was still missing. Parents have gathered at the location since Monday, waiting for news of their children. Ahmad Ihsan, 52, arrived Monday evening, shocked after being notified about the disaster through a parent's WhatsApp group. He was sure that his son, 14-year-old Arif Afandi, was still alive when he started the hour-long drive from the city of Surabaya. But Mr. Ihsan was distressed when he learned that his son was among the missing students. "I'm still hoping my child is safe and will return to us," Mr. Ihsan said. He described his youngest son as a kind and religious boy whose eldest sister graduated from the same school a few years ago. Mr. Ihsan said that the boarding school apologized to families and asked for the parents' forgiveness, calling the collapse an accident. They held a joint prayer service for the trapped students on Thursday morning. Pratikno, the coordinating minister for human development and cultural affairs, promised that the government would evaluate regulations regarding Islamic boarding schools with the Ministry of Religious Affairs. He offered condolences on behalf of the government. "We will also coordinate with the Minister of Infrastructure to ensure that disasters like this won't happen again," Mr. Pratikno said at a news conference. Officials blamed technical failure for the collapse of the building, which had been undergoing construction to add a fourth floor. Workers had been pouring concrete on the top floor when its pillars gave way, sending the upper part of the structure crashing into a lower floor where students were praying, officials said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Costly and deadly wildfires really are on the rise, new research finds. The past decade in particular has seen an uptick in devastating blazes linked to climate change, according to the study by Rebecca Zombach. The Los Angeles fires in January, blazes in Canada in 2024, Hawaii burning in 2023. It seems as though every year the planet has more huge wildfires that devastate communities, but so far the science has been sparse on whether the most economically damaging fires really are on the rise. Now, a new study has found that catastrophic wildfires with both high economic costs and loss of human life are indeed happening more often, and that those fires are strongly linked to climate change. The past decade in particular has seen a significant uptick in costly, deadly fires, according to the study, which was published on Thursday in the journal Science. "It's a pretty big wake-up call," said Brian Harvey, a professor of forest fire science at the University of Washington, who was not involved in the new study. "We live on a flammable planet, and that flammability is increasing. Fire is a natural and beneficial part of many ecosystems, but climate change can make fire seasons longer, hotter, and drier. On top of that, humans have been artificially suppressing wildfire for decades, which creates more fuel for fires and moving deeper into fire-prone areas. That sets the stage for damaging fires in urban settings," said Callum Cunningham, a wildfire scientist at the University of Tasmania who led the new study. "We've predisposed fire to occur under the most extreme conditions, where there's lots of fuel on the worst possible days," Dr. Cunningham said. "That leads to catastrophic, uncontrollable fires." Some earlier research did not find evidence that disastrous wildfires are becoming more common. A 2016 paper, for instance, looked for trends in damaging fires worldwide from 1984 to 2013 and found little evidence supporting an increase in direct losses from fire. But the climate is changing rapidly, and in every year following the end of that study, several huge fires occurred. So Dr. Cunningham wanted to know, are these big damaging fires really getting more frequent, or is that just a perception? To find out, the researchers used two data sets, one public and one private, of wildfire-related costs and fatalities around the world between 1980 and 2023. They identified the 200 most costly fires, measuring losses relative to each country's gross domestic product to avoid biases toward lower-income countries. They also included wildfires with 10 or more direct fatalities, bringing the total of most damaging wildfires to 242. Based on those 242 wildfires, the researchers found the number of disastrous wildfires had increased more than fourfold from 1980 to 2023. Nearly half of the fires, 43%, were in the last 10 years of the record. Additionally, There were 43 wildfire disasters that cost more than $1 billion in the same period. The Trump administration said in May it would stop tracking billion-dollar disasters that occur in the United States. The findings contrast with those of the 2016 paper, now not even a decade old, but Christina Santin, a wildfire scientist with the Spanish National Research Council and the author of that earlier paper, was not surprised that the new study had found a different answer from hers. She was glad to see an updated look at trends in damaging wildfires. "This is proof that things are getting worse," Dr. Santin said. "We need to adapt to live with fire. This is our reality, and it's not going anywhere." The disastrous fires were largely clustered in the western part of North America, southern Europe, and southern Australia, and mostly in affluent areas with high property values, but not exclusively. Wildfire disasters also struck in the tropics and the far north, mostly driven by unusually strong droughts, and in more rural regions like Nepal that don't often get Western media coverage, they hit every continent except Antarctica. Dr. Cunningham put it simply, "They're everywhere," he said. The researchers then checked to see if the increase in disastrous wildfires had any associations with climate change. They found that the fires were closely associated with fire weather, which includes strong, dry winds, high temperatures, and drought. Other research has found that fire weather is on the rise as a result of climate change. "It's clear that these events are driven by extreme weather," Dr. Cunningham said. "Climate change isn't solely responsible for all the disastrous wildfires in the study," he stressed, "but it sets the stage for them. Climate change is creating more opportunities for a catastrophic fire," he said. Together, the findings are a pretty strong collection of evidence that socioeconomic costs from disastrous wildfires are increasing, and that climate is a big part of the equation, Dr. Harvey said. "This really hammers home the fact that things are rapidly changing, and we really need to better understand them to be able to address them." Voice of America stops all broadcasting after government shuts down. During past shutdowns, the Federal News Agency continued broadcasting to authoritarian countries as it was considered essential to national security, by Minho Kim. The Trump administration suspended all news broadcasts from Voice of America and furloughed all its journalists on Wednesday after the government shut down, effectively fulfilling its efforts to shutter the agency 2 days after a judge ordered it to reinstate workers and restore programming. Nearly all the 80 or so remaining employees at the agency, which broadcast news to countries with limited press freedom, are furloughed. Mass furloughs and the suspension of news programming did not occur during past shutdowns, as providing news coverage to authoritarian countries like Russia, China, and Iran was considered essential to national security. Voice of America broadcasts have been suspended due to a funding cut from the United States government, which has led to a government shutdown, reads a recent notice posted on the website for the news network's Persian language service. Similar notices appeared on the network's websites for other language services, including Mandarin, Dari, and Pashto. But a shutdown preparation document published last year by the news group's oversight agency, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, listed about 650 Voice of America employees and journalists as essential to perform activities expressly authorized by law. A similar document published last month, however, does not designate Voice of America as essential, although it mentions the Office of Cuba Broadcasting, another federal agency that provides news coverage to Cubans in Spanish as foreign relations activities essential to national security. Carrie Lake, a fierce Trump ally and the acting chief executive at the oversight agency, said her agency was following all applicable law and related guidance from the White House's Office of Management and Budget. But she did not say what had prompted her agency to make such drastic changes to the number of employees deemed essential to national security, or why broadcasting to Cuba was treated differently than to other adversaries. President Trump has threatened to leverage the shutdown to fire or lay off more federal workers and slash programs that he disfavors. On Tuesday, he threatened to fire a lot of federal workers during the shutdown, despite legal challenges from workers' unions to the president's authority to do so. The decision to pause broadcasting and furlough all journalists arrived 2 days after a Reagan-appointed federal judge mandated that the government rescind layoff notices sent to more than 500 Voice of America employees. On Wednesday, the agency furloughed those and about 80 more people. On Monday, that judge, Roy C. Lamberth of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, threatened to hold Trump officials in contempt for failing to restore the volume of news programming at Voice of America to roughly what it had been before March, as he had ordered. Voice of America had been airing news broadcasts to 360 million people in 49 languages every week until mid-March, when Mr. Trump effectively ordered the agency's dismantling. Since then, it provided about an hour-long news service every day in each of 4 languages: Persian, spoken in Iran and neighboring countries; Mandarin, and the 2 main languages spoken in Afghanistan, Dari and Pashto. Judge Lamberth had for weeks tried to obtain adequate information that would demonstrate the Trump administration's compliance with his ruling from April, when he ordered a restoration of Voice of America's news coverage so that it could serve as a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. The defendant's obfuscation of this court's request for information, he wrote on Monday, has wasted precious judicial time and resources and readily support contempt proceedings. The 3 plaintiffs representing Voice of America employees in a lawsuit against the Trump administration, Kate Nieper, Jessica Jurit, and Patsy Wittakuswara, said in a joint statement that the shuttering of the news group was heartbreaking. "We've always served our audiences and continued performing our vital national security role while explaining U.S. policy during past shutdowns," they said. "What Voice of America once was is now further diminished." What Jane Goodall taught us about living a long life. The scientist who died at 91 on Wednesday was a model for healthy aging. By Dana G. Smith and Nina Agrawal. Jane Goodall, who died on Wednesday at the age of 91, followed several principles that geriatricians recommend for a long and healthy life. A scientist, conservationist, and author, Dr. Goodall stayed active, working until the day she died. She had a clear sense of purpose for her life, and she was an enduring optimist. Over a nearly 7-decade career, Dr. Goodall taught us about the intelligence of chimpanzees, but she left behind powerful teachings about aging and living well, too. According to the Jane Goodall Institute, Dr. Goodall traveled approximately 300 days a year, espousing her message of hope through action. While foregoing retirement might not be for everyone, Ken Stern, the author of Healthy to 100, a book that examines longevity around the world, said that people who work longer typically live longer. "We tend to associate work with stress, which is bad for you," Mr. Stern said. "But in fact, working in later years is clearly beneficial from a healthy longevity perspective. Research shows that people who retire in their early 60s have a greater risk of death in the following years than those who stop working later, regardless of their health before retirement. People also tend to experience accelerated cognitive decline as well as higher rates of depression after they retire. Some of the benefits of a later retirement probably stem from the fact that work keeps you physically active and engaged with the world." Dr. Goodall's travel schedule meant she was moving and getting out of the house, Mr. Stern said. "Dr. Goodall's work may have offered other health advantages," said Dr. Margaret Flanagan, a neuropathologist at the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. Famously, Dr. Goodall spent a lot of time in nature, which has been linked to lower cortisol levels, lower blood pressure, and less inflammation. The socially and cognitively stimulating aspects of her more recent work, writing books and speaking to large audiences, probably benefited Dr. Goodall as well. "Social interactions are especially important as we age because they force us to exercise skills that we often take for granted," said Dr. Stephanie Collier, the director of education in the geriatric psychiatry division at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts. "These include carrying on a conversation, using certain vocabulary, and considering different worldviews. Being around others can also help lower stress and anxiety," Dr. Collier added. Dr. Goodall's work clearly gave her a strong sense of meaning or purpose, which has been associated with a longer lifespan. One study, published in 2019, found that out of nearly 7,000 adults over the age of 50, those who scored highest on a measure asking about life purpose had less than half the risk of dying over the next 4 years compared with those who scored lowest. Feeling like you have something to do, some reason for being, is powerful, said Dr. Allison Moore, the director of the Stein Institute for Research on Aging and the Center for Healthy Aging at the University of California, San Diego. Jane Goodall certainly had it. That sense of purpose can give people a reason to take better care of their physical health, Dr. Moore said. They want to stay in as good shape as they can to continue to be able to pursue the things that matter to them. If work doesn't provide a feeling of meaning, it could come from spirituality, relationships, or a new hobby, Dr. Collier said. Whatever inspires it, having purpose in life gives people motivation to keep learning, to keep interacting, and to keep getting out of bed, she said, elements that can fall by the wayside in older age. Dr. Goodall was an optimist. In her last book, published in 2021, The Book of Hope, A Survival Guide for Trying Times, she laid out what gives her hope, even in the face of climate change and other serious global challenges. Research has shown that optimists live longer. For example, in an ongoing decades-long study of aging and dementia in a group of Catholic nuns, those who expressed more positive emotions in early life writings lived on average 7 to 10 years longer than those whose writings were the least positive. The association remained after adjusting for education and linguistic ability, suggesting that optimism may help buffer stress and foster resilience, said Dr. Flanagan, who now leads the study. Even when it came to death, Dr. Goodall maintained a positive attitude. In a 2021 interview with the New York Times, she was asked about her next great adventure. Her answer? Dying. When you die, there's either nothing, in which case I'm finished, or there's something, she said. I happen to think that there's something from various experiences I've had, and if that's so, then I can't think of a greater adventure than finding out what's there, what's next. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Friday, October 3rd issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chris Wilhelm. Thank you for listening.